In that case, we'll wait a minute till. We'll just wait till everyone. Till the entire place empties.
Now that the excitement is over?
Right. Oh, do you need to lift the podium? If you do,
if it's okay, if I can be heard, I don't need to lift it. I'm okay. Thank you.
Will it filter through the mic?
It will pick up.
Okay, I don't want you hunching over. 10C330. I'm sorry. 112656, Stoller versus Steak and Shake Enterprises. And good morning, Mr. Flum.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Barry Blum, and I'm here for the appellants, the Steak and Shake appellants, who were the defendants below. Your Honor, this is an appeal of a preliminary injunction that was entered against Steak and Shake, prohibiting it from enforcing a policy that it had implemented at every one of the Steak and Shake restaurants in America, including 413 company restaurants and 70 other franchise restaurants. And the injunction prohibits Steak and Shake from enforcing that policy against Stoller, who is a franchisee at 5 restaurants in Illinois. The case turns on the issue of whether a preliminary injunction may be granted without a showing of actual injury to the plaintiff resulting from the challenged conduct, here compliance with the policy that was being implemented, but instead where the only harm that the injunction upon which the injunction is based is entirely avoidable by the plaintiff, and really more accurately would be intentionally incurred by the plaintiff by not.
We'll get to that theory in a moment. Could I ask you at the threshold, Mr. Blum, your reply brief at page 1 seems to suggest this appeal is moot because you're not really interested in terminating the franchises.
Well, Your Honor, we are we're not interested in terminating. That's not the purpose, and there was that argument was made.
You did
below.
Threaten to terminate, correct?
Default notices were sent on 2 of the 5.
And you sent your email from was it December 20th?
Yes, Your Honor.
I was a little troubled by your footnote 3 in your reply brief, where you seem to be suggesting that your email should not have been taken seriously.
But
did I misunderstand that?
No, Your Honor. It was meant to be taken seriously, but
as what?
It was
as a threat to terminate.
No, as an advisement that that Steak and Shake was going to insist on enforcement of the policy, and that if it was not complied with, they could proceed on to for a possible default and termination.
The plaintiff should go seek an injunction.
Correct.
So I don't understand your position here. You seem to be wanting to say we're nice guys, we don't really want to terminate, but we are going to keep our glove in a fist. Have I understood that correctly?
Well, Your Honor, what the position of Steak and Shake below was that we do want Stoller to comply with the franchise agreements, which they should do.
And the district court came to the opposite conclusion, but that's a different story. We'll get to that.
Right.
But in terms of whether you believe you have a right to terminate and an intention to terminate these franchises if they don't comply.
We believe that if they do not comply, after it would be appropriate to send a notice of default. In fact, 2 were sent, although the lawsuit was filed during the cure period. There were no default notices sent on the other 3.
Just your email.
Just my email.
Which says you're in default.
Well, it says that if they do not comply, because, Your Honor, if you recall, at the beginning of the case, before actually I appeared, there was an emergency hearing, and Steak and Shake said, let's status quo here.
I'm quoting your memo.
Right.
This is to notify you that Steak and Shake Enterprises demands that Stoller, Inc. remedy its default under its 5 franchise agreements by complying with the policy on or before January 24, 2011. That's not a notice of default?
It is not a notice of default under the franchise agreement, Your Honor, because a notice under the franchise agreements.
Do you expect us to take that seriously? You're splitting hairs on your own message like that?
Well, no, Your Honor, because the because we actually, if in the transcript of the hearing, the before Magistrate Judge Cudmore, that was raised up where, remember, the evidentiary hearing wasn't until March. We did not act on January 25th or February.
The injunction
February
was pending. Mm-hmm.
Well, there was a motion for a preliminary injunction was pending. But and we even had a discussion with Judge Cudmore on there where we said, Judge, they filed their motion, which we wanted to bring to issue and bring the court, we did not go forward because I know that Your Honor would say that it would be improper to terminate.
Let me try this again. If the franchisee does not comply with your pricing policy demands, is it your intention to terminate the five franchises?
It would be Steak and Shake. It is Steak and Shake has the right to send a notice of default, which if cured would be terminated. Yes, they could take enforcement to default, which if not cured would terminate.
That's it, and you will terminate. So this is not moot. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Steak and Shake will take enforcement action, yes, to enforce the franchise agreements.
Notwithstanding the statements in your reply brief. All right, why don't we proceed to the merits of the...
Well, except that I really did wonder if, you know, why Steak and Shake changed course on its original agreement not to take action to enforce the policy during the pendency of the litigation. I mean, I really have been wondering.
Well, Your Honor, I was not counsel at that time. There was an emergency hearing. I believe it was on the day before Thanksgiving or 2 days before. And there has been a dispute in this case as to what Steak and Shake's counsel at that hearing said. In fact, Judge Mim, who was in the case at that time, denied the original preliminary injunction as moot. But he didn't deny it and say we're going forward. In fact, the discussion at that hearing, Steak and Shake's position is that, listen, let's try to not run into this now. We're all here. Let's try to resolve this and see if we can work through it. And then eventually it was clear that Stuller was not going to move forward. Well, every other franchisee in the system did, in fact, move forward, some under protest, et cetera.
Okay.
So and the decision was, and we didn't just send out notices of default or try to terminate. It's communicated to the other side, listen, here's either file your motion or kind of we'll proceed forward with, we would have had to send a notice of default and the like, and then you can go get an injunction. We had hearings at that time with Judge Mim, who was still in the case also, who on scheduling hearings, et cetera. So that was the purpose of this, to allow Stuller the opportunity not to sort of now send notices of default, say now we're trying to enforce the policy, but to give them, you know, 6 weeks or so to say, if you believe that you aren't and you don't have to comply, we want to give you the opportunity to file the injunction. We wanted to bring the injunction issue, their entitlement to an injunction, to a head so that it could be decided by the court rather than... I don't think there's anything in the record that shows that Steak and Shake conceded to the preliminary injunction at that initial hearing before Judge Mim.
Is this as much a business decision to warn everybody else? Mm-hmm. You stay in line, so we're going to make an example out of these people. Let them know that we're not messing around. Everybody's got to lower their price, and then you say, well, because by lowering it, everybody makes more money, which is an interesting result. I guess if I were a franchise holder, I might even take a look at why that happened. But it seems that this I guess this is the original. Is this the original or just the oldest franchisee?
This is the. Have been the first of the franchisees. Yes.
Yeah. Well, so they've got a long history of doing what they want to do, apparently, and aren't going to relent, even though it may lose money. I know there's lots of issues, but I just wondered if this is just sort of a warning to everyone else: stay in line, and everyone else seemed to line up.
Well, Your Honor, actually,
75 are independent, and the rest are owned.
By the company.
Yeah, so obviously the one's owned by the company.
Right. There's well, in fact, Your Honor, as the record shows that franchisees operating 48 restaurants, 48 of the 75, voluntarily adopted the policy and the pricing a year prior to this lawsuit. That was the test market that was done. So all of the company restaurants and 48 franchisees, or franchisees operating 48 restaurants, mm-hmm. adopted this policy a year earlier. So there was a year of track record in which those 48 restaurants, on average, far outperformed the stellar restaurants.
So just your question about business decisions, and this seems to me the one that you want everybody else to get in line. I'll back off. I don't want to dwell on it.
You claim that the only possible harm that the Stoller could suffer from implementing the policy would be monetary loss. But if they're forced to lower the prices and they subsequently win the lawsuit, isn't there a real risk of being unable to raise the prices again without losing numerous customers? And wouldn't that be irreparable harm?
Well, Your Honor, no, I don't believe that. There's certainly not anything in the record. They did not offer any expert testimony of any marketing person or economist to suggest that. But companies, you know, move their prices back and forth. And there was no evidence in the record, either underlying the report and recommendation or the magistrate judge's report, that suggested that if they lowered it, they can't raise this again. And, there is evidence that the prices of Steak and Shake products have moved over time. But back to Judge Manning, your opinion, your question, this was not a business decision to enforce people to – this was a policy that was adopted across the board as part of the Steak and Shake marketing and promotions program.
Is it uniform across the country?
Across the country, Your Honor.
Yes, it is. Whether you're in the middle of Chicago where costs are very high or without mistakes like where I live?
Yes, Your Honor.
Same price.
It's pricing and promotions four under $4. I don't know if you've seen that advertising. It's those kind of mandatory promotions, yes, on the products that were covered. So it was maximum a la carte pricing and then guidelines with promotions. It was a business decision that was implemented, again, a year in advance prior to the lawsuit. So in 48 of the franchisees voluntarily adopted, and based on that, the company implemented it as a policy so that Steak and Shake can advertise this on television. You know, we can't advertise it on television in a market if not all the franchisees
understand the business theory. You've got contract problems, and the district court found a likelihood of success on the merits for the other side. You're not challenging that decision in this appeal, are you?
We're not finding that they met the likelihood of success standard for...
So that's not really an issue here.
Right.
Now, so your self-inflicted harm theory then would apply, if I understand it, even if the franchisee's likelihood of success on the merits was 100%, correct?
If the franchisee's likelihood of success was 100%?
Yep. Your argument's the same, right?
Well, the franchisee still would not have proved adequate remedy of law,
so
because
it's
a threshold issue, each
okay.
of those separately.
So we can assume that they're right on the merits, or at least that your theory would produce the same result. How would your theory apply, for example, if you came in and demanded, let's say, across the board 20% price cuts? Same answer? You could still avoid irreparable harm of termination by complying with our demands.
But it depends on what the proof was as to what impact that would have on the franchisee.
Well, presumably a 20% across the board price cut would be pretty devastating, right?
Well,
if you're not willing to agree with that, how about 50%?
Well, again, Your Honor, at 50% at a certain point,
okay.
without making an assumption that the prices
would
were
be your position, would it be your position that the harm would be self-inflicted and therefore no injunction should issue if Steak and Shake had come in demanding a 50% price cut?
Well, Your Honor, in a vacuum,
Could you please answer the question?
I would have to say that if we had come in and demanded a 50% price cut, the proof would have been able to be made that this would have been very devastating or very harmful to their business.
So would you agree then that if there is sufficient financial harm in the interim, that would be irreparable and not
yes.
self-inflicted?
Yes. Under the Roland case that shows that if the financial harm is they're not likely to survive during the trial. Clearly, that's irreparable.
So if it's serious enough, we don't treat it as self-inflicted under your theory, right?
Well, that's because the harm in that case would be caused by us, would be caused by us putting in the policy.
No. You're saying that by making, that if the franchisee has to comply with your wrongful demand under the contract, and that's the presumption here, that they're right on the breach of contract issue, that if the franchisee refuses to comply with that wrongful demand, any financial harm they suffer is self-inflicted.
If the harm comes from the simple refusal. Remember, there are two harms.
Either you terminate or they have to buckle under, right?
Right. What our position is that the irreparable harm based on the financial losses is a separate harm. If they tried to prove that they would lose business and that they would go out of business, that was what the entire evidentiary hearing was about. And the magistrate judge found that they failed to prove that. See, the loss from the 50% price reduction, if they establish that, that would be irreparable harm.
And a basis for a preliminary injunction.
And if they establish...
So it would not just be self-inflicted.
If the harm was caused by their implementation of the policy, as opposed to their not implementing the policy, would not hurt them.
This doesn't make any sense. You've given them two choices. Cut your prices according to corporate policy, or you're terminated, right?
Yes.
Termination is irreparable.
Termination of their franchises would be, harm that probably would be irreparable harm.
We would treat that as irreparable.
Yes.
And you're arguing that their refusal to change the pricing policy means that termination would be self-inflicted, right?
Yes, because on the record, following the policy would not harm them at all.
That's an interesting reading of the record, but okay.
Well, but the Judge Cudmore, I believe, found that.
But the district judge did not.
She did not make any findings on what the harm would be to the... She actually did find that there would be no harm. No other franchisee adopting the policy was harmed, and that everyone who did adopt it did better than Stellar did in the
interim. Better in terms of net profits or just sales and customer count?
Well, the plaintiff, who was the move-in...
What did your evidence show on that?
Our evidence showed a comparable sales increase from one year to the next after implementing.
Gross sales.
It's called net sales after some discounts.
Profit.
But largely, there were no... The plaintiff put on no evidence of profit.
I'm asking about your evidence.
Our evidence was the sales of these franchisees from one year to the next. One year they did not have the policy in place. The next year they did.
Okay.
And that was the issue that the plaintiff put on no, only put on sales evidence.
Because what happened? Did they make more money? I didn't say more sales, more money. Did they have profits increase?
Right. Then the plaintiff put on no evidence, and Judge Cudmore specifically found that Stellar, the moving party, put on no evidence of profitability or lost profits.
That's not about the ones that went along with the program.
Well, our evidence was put on in response to Stellar's. There was no person who came in, no other franchisee who said, my sales went up, but my profits went down. The average of those 48 went up 7.1%. And there's nothing in the record that show a franchisee sales would go up. No top line sales.
Yeah, but see, if you sell something for half price, you're going to sell a lot more of them.
I understand that, but again, that was the plaintiff's burden to show lost profits, and they failed to do it. They put on no evidence of profits.
You know, in balancing the harms, it really doesn't seem like there's any sort of appreciable risk of harm to Steak and Shake. Unless it's the threat that other franchisees will feel free to disregard the policy. Is there any other?
Yeah, that's exactly it, Your Honor. First of all, we believe that you don't get to the balancing of the harms because likelihood of success and irreparable harm, adequate remedy at law, are threshold issues. And if you don't prove either of them, we don't get to the balancing. But that is the issue, and it was argued below that other franchisees, this is a system. Every other franchisee is in compliance. Every franchisee. We did put on testimony that, for example, in the Springfield market, we can't advertise on television, despite that there are company restaurants in this market. We can't advertise.
You haven't appealed on the balance of harms analysis, right?
Mm. No, we have not, Your Honor.
Okay.
You know, of course, Stoller believes that Steak and Shake is in breach of contract by demanding compliance with the pricing policy. And in that case, by forcing him to adopt the policy, it is, in fact, Steak and Shake that would be inflicting the injury.
Well, again, Your Honor, there's no evidence in this record, and this was what was found by the magistrate judge, and the district judge did not dispute this, that shows that following the policy would cause Stoller irreparable harm, put them out of business. It would only be not following. I mean, in the cases we cite, in the Roland case, in the Second City case that we cite, the retailer did not believe that it had to follow this licensing statute. And in fact, it was going to go fight it down below, you know, and fight the constitutionality of it. But the court said, well, but it won't hurt you to follow it in the interim. And that's exactly, I think, what the case is here. The evidence is that they will not be hurt, or they failed to prove at all that they would be hurt by following this in the interim. So otherwise, they can't, you know, they make sort of coming in anytime there's a contract dispute to make it sort of routine to come get an injunction. Thank you.
Thank you. You used all of your time, but we forced you to do that. I will give you a minute or so. And we're going to have to add 4 minutes to your argument. I mean, only if you want it. Don't feel...
We'll see if I need it. May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Josh Stevens, and I represent the appellee Stoller Incorporated. To begin with, I think it is important to note, as Mr. Blum conceded, that Steak and Shake does not appeal the district court's finding that Stoller has a likelihood of success on the merits of its claim, that Steak and Shake does not have the right to implement the pricing policy, and that termination of Stoller's franchises for failing to implement the policy would be irreparable harm.
You know, my bottom line question, I guess, if I had, you know, only one to ask you, would be, what evidence in the record supports your claim that if Stoller implements the policy, he will experience what you, and I'm quoting, call financial ruin? None of the other 48 franchisees, it would seem, that implemented the policy had such an experience, did they?
Well, Judge, I think it's important to recall from the record that Steak and Shake put no evidence into the record regarding the profit loss that those 48 franchisees might have experienced. They put no evidence into the record as to that profit loss. Steak and Shake, or Stoller, however, did put evidence into the record that it would lose between $615,000 and $695,000. Steak and Shake's financial expert, Mr. Poppelman, testified that he could not dispute that $615,000 to $695,000 range of loss. The other important thing to point out is that Stoller put into evidence an exhibit number 36, which was actually a financial analysis prepared by Steak and Shake pre-litigation, that showed that Stoller would be expected to lose $648,000 if it implemented the pricing policy.
Just on the basis of the price increase?
Just on the basis of the price decrease, yes.
Are there other Steak and Shake franchises in the Springfield area?
We are the only Steak and Shake franchises in the Springfield area.
Okay, so there's no comparative there. And they complain because they can't advertise nationally or whatever in Springfield. I don't know anything about the advertising demographics, but is it possible just to isolate Springfield and advertise everywhere else?
Well, I think that's what they're doing, Your Honor. And the balance of the harms analysis done by the district court didn't find that they would be harmed at all by Stoller not implementing the policy during the pendency of litigation. And I think that's reflected in the relatively minimal bond that was required of Stoller.
Well, take potential economic loss out of the equation for just a moment. What other potential harm do you face from implementing this policy?
The other potential harm, and as Wilma Stoller did testify during the preliminary injunction hearing, is that once you raise your prices, once you lower your prices, customers get used to that price decrease, and it's difficult to raise them back up.
Yeah, but that's economic loss. I'm asking about other potential harm.
Then economic loss, loss of customer goodwill, loss of reputation. These Steak and Shake restaurants in Springfield are not fast food restaurants. They're not known like that. They're diners, and they're ran like that.
Do they differ from other?
Yes. They're 70-year-old franchises, and they really are run differently than most franchises, Steak and Shake franchises in the country.
So they really do sell steaks.
Yeah. Steak do they have white tablecloths and flowers? I mean, what are you saying?
Well, we're saying that for 70 years, Stoller has set its own menu prices and been able to be very successful in doing so. And it proved at the preliminary injunction hearing that adopting the corporate pricing policy like it did back in 2008 voluntarily caused it a huge loss.
Oh, you proved that. What did the magistrate judge find on that, and what did the district judge find on that?
The magistrate judge made proposed conclusions regarding the financial impact of the policy. Those conclusions were that Stoller had not met its threshold standard of proving irreparable harm from implementing the policy. But the district court did not adopt those proposed conclusions. The district court only adopted the statement of facts section of the report and recommendation, which really was just a recitation of the evidence and testimony presented at the preliminary injunction hearing.
So what did the district court find on this issue?
The district court, Your Honor, made no finding because it found that Stoller shouldn't have to acquiesce in a violation of its rights to avoid unlawful termination.
Let me ask you about that. Let's suppose we weren't talking about this kind of degree of financial harm, but suppose we're closer to something involving the Second City Music case. Let's suppose you've got a franchisor demanding, contrary to the terms of the contract, that you work harder at cleaning the franchise premises, or do some better landscaping, or maybe add a couple of items to the menu so it'll be consistent with nationwide menus, where it would be a lot easier to comply. Shouldn't that make a difference in the analysis?
Well, I don't think it should, but because really what Steak and Shake is asking is that it be able to use unlawful termination as a threat to compel almost any conduct.
Well, that assumes, likelihood of success on the merits, a very strong likelihood of success. I don't want to be coy about this, but this seems to me to be an area where bright line rules simply do not apply, where a district judge is expected to use sound judgment and discretion in evaluating how burdensome compliance would be, how strong a showing has been made on the likelihood of success on the merits, how the balance of harms works. And here we're being asked to kind of look at this through the tunnel vision of the self-inflicted harm theory. Mm-hmm. But I'm trying to suggest to you that if compliance would be very easy for the franchisee, painless, that also would be a factor that the district judge could take into account.
I think that the district court judge could take that into account, but I still feel like that you'd be kind of it'd be a slippery slope analysis. So you would be requiring a movement to cooperate in a violation of its contractual rights.
No, there's slippery slopes all over the place with sure. Injunctive law.
There is, but using the Second City case as an example, in that case, the movement made no showing that it was likely to succeed on the merits of its claim that the business license requirement was a violation of its constitutional rights. So as a result, in that case, the movement would not be harmed because there would be no violation of its rights by getting the business license.
That doesn't entirely capture the reasoning of the court, though. Right, the reasoning of the court was comparing this to, for example, folks who had religious objections to applying for licenses. There really was no showing that this would be any significant burden at all to apply and wait and see what happened.
The district court, Your Honor, found that Stoller's breach of its franchises would arise out of Steak and Shake's breach of contract, mm-hmm. not Stoller's. So, you know, Steak and Shake is, or Stoller's not threatening to terminate its own franchises. Steak and Shake is. And the harm we sought to prevent in moving for a preliminary injunction was unlawful termination.
Mr. Stevens, could I ask you, since the injunction was issued, what's been happening in the district court?
So there was a trial scheduled for January 21st of 2012. About a month and a half before that trial, the district court ordered rebriefing of summary judgment and called off the trial indefinitely. So this June the 1st, we go to the Central District and hear that motion for preliminary or motion for summary judgment. There's a
whose motion? Cross, cross motions?
Yes, there was cross motions.
If, well, that could moot the whole appeal, right?
It could moot the whole appeal, yes.
Okay.
One other thing to point out, Your Honors, is that the Milson case that we cite in our brief is really more instructive than the Second City case. In that case, the franchisor threatened the franchisee with termination for its failure to abide by a corporate pricing policy and its failure to make royalty payments. The franchisee in that case sought a preliminary injunction against termination, which this court ordered. The court in Milson did not dive into an analysis of whether the franchisee could avoid irreparable harm by adopting the pricing policy or by paying the royalties during the pendency of litigation, because it found that in effect, if it would allow the franchisor to enforce the policies by threatening termination, it would have been approving possible antitrust violations. Here, the same, if the district court would allow Stoller to enforce the policies by threatening termination, it would be approving possible breaches of contract and breaches of the IFDA.
So are you arguing that implementing the policy in the short term would cause irreparable harm, or are you really maintaining that you have no obligation to implement the policy, and so the only threatened harm really is the loss of the franchises?
Correct, Your Honor. And Steak and Shake doesn't appeal.
Which?
Correct. We have no obligation to implement the policy during the pendency of litigation. The district or Steak and Shake does not appeal the likelihood of success on the merits. They've so much as conceded that for this the purpose of this appeal that Stoller does not have the obligation to implement the policy.
I thought your position was absolutely yes, you would suffer irreparable harm by implementing the policy.
We would suffer irreparable harm by implementing the policy, but the harm we seek to avoid is unlawful termination.
Oh. So both. You don't want that choice.
Either way,
that's
you
what
measure,
the injunction
Your Honor,
saves you from.
Exactly.
If the injunction were saving you from a choice between the painless license application in Second City and loss of the business, there's no irreparable harm, right?
Can you repeat the question, Your Honor?
If the injunction were needed to save you only from a painless license application, as in Second City, and on the one hand, and loss of your business on the other, then there's really no need under the Second City reasoning for an injunction, right? So the real question is, how much would it hurt for you all to comply with a demand that breaches the contract unless and until you succeed on the merits in the final judgment, right?
I think the real question, Your Honor, is how much would it hurt from the unlawful termination of Stoller's franchises for refusing to cooperate in a breach of the contract. So to reverse the district court's order, the court would first have to find that Stoller
Let me go back to an earlier hypothetical. Suppose Steak and Shake's only demand that breached the contract was you've got to add two items to your menus. Presumably you could do that without a whole lot of trouble, right?
And that would be an easy business decision, Your Honor.
And there would be no need for an injunction, even if you could ultimately prove, no, they're not entitled to demand this of us.
We wouldn't acquiesce in a violation of our rights in that situation to avoid unlawful termination unless it made business sense. In that case, Steak and Shake could sue us for breach of the franchise agreements and seek their own preliminary injunction if they thought it necessary. But I think the point in A.W. Chesterton, for instance, is that equity doesn't require a party to acquiesce in a violation of its rights to avoid a claim that harm is self-inflicted. So, you know, the preliminary injunction motion was designed to prevent unlawful termination. And the district court ordered the preliminary injunction to prevent unlawful termination. But, you know, and this can be illustrated in the General Leaseways case that we cite in our brief, which is similar to Milson, where the franchisee refused to abide by location and non-affiliation restriction policies of its franchisor. In that case, the court didn't dive into an analysis of whether adoption of those contested policies during the pendency of litigation would cause irreparable harm. It focused on termination as the harm the franchisee sought to avoid. And that's because you can't, your money or your life is not an acceptable demand in contract law.
Unless you're Jack Benny.
What's the difference between the two and the five? There were two that were singled out. Are they differently constructed or located?
They're in different locations. They're not differently constructed.
Are they one or two of them better than the rest?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. It's a mystery to me why the default notices were only sent to two out of the five franchises. But they later clearly did follow up with the default notice directed at all five franchises.
Tell me something. All Steak and Shake restaurants use exactly the same ingredients bought from the same purveyors?
There is a list of approved vendors, I believe, Your Honor.
Oh, so they can choose.
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
But so then quality could be different in different places.
Well, all Steak and Shake restaurants, although they're franchises, I mean, they do have a certain amount of leeway in how they manage their restaurants. They used to have leeway in how they price their menu items. A franchisee is only should only be required to adopt its franchisor's policies, the policies that are outlined in the franchise agreements, and I think that's all we're asking of Steak and Shake.
Do they wear uniforms?
They do.
Everywhere?
I don't know about everywhere, Your Honor.
So you can determine what people wear in your restaurant. You may have, we got earlier about the distinction, maybe these are fancier restaurants where they can dress up nice.
Yeah, I was thinking a better class of skirt.
I think one other thing to mention, Your Honor, is that although Mr. Blum said that every Steak and Shake restaurant in the country has adopted this policy, many of these franchisees did adopt the policy under a reservation of rights. So they formed a franchise association and did adopt that policy. So in sum, Your Honors, we contend that equity does not require a party to acquiesce in a violation of its rights. Stoller respectfully requests that this court uphold the district court's order granting the preliminary injunction.
Hey, so what have we got now for Mr. Blum? Minutes. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Can you do it?
I will try.
Negotiating the price.
I think Judge Hamilton hit on the point that really is the essence of our case. This is like Second City because the plaintiff, asking for a preliminary injunction, failed to prove on this record that it would suffer any harm, that it would be harmed by doing it. Just like the retailer there could apply for a license and get it, and go back and fight the constitutionality. The trial court's reasoning and their position made the entire evidentiary hearing meaningless because, frankly, had the proof been that their sales would have gone up 10%, their profits would have gone up 10%, they'd still be entitled to a preliminary injunction. Because if they still said, our sales and profits are up 10%, but we just don't want to do this. We don't think it's right. We don't think it's going to last. We could then send a notice of default, and they would lose their franchise agreements. The harm wasn't caused by compliance. It's caused by noncompliance. Just as the retailer in Second City did not believe it had the statute was constitutional, the court said, but you know what? You won't be harmed by getting it, and you'll only lose your business by not getting it. So,
Would you agree that Second City also pointed out, however, for example, that somebody who had a religious objection to applying for the license would suffer irreparable harm, right?
Yes.
Okay. So it's not a very high threshold, is it?
Well, the religious objection obviously brings in constitutional problems and the like that aren't present here. But one point is very important. The evidence put on, Stellar's counsel indicated that Steak and Shake didn't put on any evidence of the lost profits. Okay, we were not the moving party that was there.
What about Exhibit 36?
First of all, the judge Myerscough specifically said, I'm not basing my injunction on Exhibit 36.
However, isn't that in the record? And what should we make of it?
Right. Well, it is. And all that Exhibit 36 was a statement of, if based on a la carte prices versus policy prices, what would the difference be? And it did show, for example, and we point this out in our reply brief, that their sales theoretically would go down 6.5%.
And that was Steak and Shake's analysis.
Well, it was a calculation by someone at Steak and Shake. It also showed, for example, that another franchisee would lose 1%. That franchisee's sales actually went up 11%. Another franchisee, it said, based on the same mathematical calculation, would go down 3%. That franchisee actually went up 8.5% in the 3 months after the litigation was filed before the evidentiary hearing. It wasn't at all any kind of economic analysis. It was a mathematical computation, which is all that they're...
If we were to agree with you, Mr. Blum, wouldn't the right answer be to simply ask the district judge to resolve these issues about the finances?
Well, that could be one remedy. I believe that, you know, after a full-blown evidentiary hearing, the magistrate judge made all these determinations
that are not final. Why shouldn't the best you could hope for be a remand for findings by the district court?
Well, I believe that the district judge did adopt those findings and then did not resolve that issue. Right. Because she skipped over and did not consider that loss. I agree with that, Your Honor.
So?
That would be a remedy. We believe that for the purposes of the injunction, it was improperly entered without that finding. But she, you're correct, did not resolve the issue she said it's not material to her decision as to whether Stellar would actually be harmed or not by implementing the policy and that sales would go down. I do agree with that, Your Honor. Thank you.
So, thanks to everyone. Go home.